how to begin and develop a military ministry. And I think that's just about what we'll come up with. However, I've tried to deal with principles all the way through, and so it probably would be a little more general than just specifically to military work. We'll make a lot of references to the military work, but in fact, the material will pretty much cover any ministry because it's dealing with principles of ministry. So the objectives today, we're going to try to cover the first three and maybe part of four, which is God's leading and promises claimed, initial objectives, future objectives, and strategy and planning. Then tomorrow we'll pick up on strategy and planning where we left off and cover the philosophy, activities, and methods, and try to put them all together in a package. And then on the third day, I had requested 2 days, but Glenn Airy requested three, so I had to figure out what to do with the third day. So I decided we'd spend the third day on training and management objectives, which closely relate to the material that we'll be covering the first 2 days. And in the training, I'm hoping to cover both selection of personnel and basic training objectives with men in various stages of growth. So certain objectives for men in follow-up, those that are in a stage of discipleship, and those that are disciple makers, and the use of shelves and packages, which may be foreign to many of you, so I'll introduce that, as we have been using these quite heavily for the last year and a half out on the East Coast, and very effectively. So that's the outline for our next three sessions. On the introduction, I just happened to have been reading a little bit relating to some of this stuff that I put in here, and it occurred to me that we're not just working with men to help them just in their spiritual lives, but we're working with the whole man. And in doing that, then we need to deal with the problems that every young man encounters. And in this day particularly, since we've been working with college students quite a bit out there for the last 2 years, I've been impressed with how this young generation, the college generation, of this day have really been influenced by some of the philosophies of the day. And that's why I injected a couple of these here. And as I really wrote the introduction after I finished all of my work, and it occurred to me that my first statement should have something to say about workshops and messages and such are not really going to teach a man much of anything. It's experience where a man really learns how to develop a ministry. And that's where I got the quote on Dr. Lynn Zell when he said, "Truth is not determined by Gallup polls, but by experience and logic." Now, on the trends of the day, I think these are really important, and that's why I started with these on our introduction, because I think we're facing cultural and social ideas and ideals all the time, and many times without knowing it. And for instance, we can begin talking to a man about Jesus Christ, and he has no knowledge of who Jesus is. In my ministry, I met two men that I really believe were sincerely honest Americans that told me they had no idea who Jesus Christ was. Well, this is growing very popular, as many of you know. And it's a problem that we need to intelligently deal with and not develop our ministry on assumptions. And above all, we can't begin with assumptions. So we're dealing with a generation that has been greatly influenced through atheistic philosophies, and I just mentioned a couple of these here. And the reason for mentioning these two, dialectical materialism and atheistic existentialism, is because they both, as you delve into them, they become, even their philosophy is obscure. And surely their conclusions, such as Dr. Joseph Crutch, who said, if you look at an existential painting, no matter how you turn the thing, it always comes out as life being meaningless. And so that's where you pick up statements by I forget the name now of this gal that committed suicide about a year and a half ago, a great singer. Pardon?
James Joplin.
Yeah, Joplin. And she just recorded a song to the effect that there's... didn't have that in my notes. Anyway, it had to do with happiness is when there's nothing else to live for, or something like that. And so she, 2 weeks after recording that, committed suicide, apparently finding nothing to live for. And I found that this philosophy is really deeply ingrained in many of the young people today, that the reason they're not stirred by any message is because they've really been influenced by the philosophy that man can only give you what you can get out of life. And there is no hereafter, and I think communism has really made its impact much more strongly than what we realize in our own country. I was reading an article by Dr. Akingay, president of Gordon College, and he said that their school begins with the theistic premise that God is there. And it was a very interesting article because he says that most of the colleges nowadays naturally begin with is God or is God dead or is there a God or whatever. And so their whole system of teaching at Gordon College is based on God is there. I won't read the rest of that. You can read that when you get a chance. Well, just that to let us realize that we're not just in the ministry to reach men or share the gospel with men, but as we train men and try to draw them into our Bible studies and other activities, I think we need to be sensitive to much of what this generation is going through. And I suppose if you've read up on Schaefer at all, you're quite familiar, probably more so than I am, with the problems of the day. I thought Dr. Orr's statement in a recent article I read was interesting. After completing a thorough study, which took apparently several years, tracing through the historic influences of evangelical Christianity in America, he made this statement at this Institute on Faith and Learning in a recent seminar. He said, the primary need of Christian colleges today is an emphasis on evangelism and disciple-making. And that kind of excited me a little bit because that's what we've been working at for quite a while. And the Lord is teaching us how to do that. Well, leading and promises. How do you determine God's leading? And we are not going to spend a lot of time on a lot of this. I just thought that if we started right from the outset, many of you have staff or will have staff or are staff that are going to begin a ministry. And so I thought we'd kind of scoot through the first part of how to begin a ministry and then as well how to develop it. So I just put a few things together that I've learned over the years and things that I've practiced in these early stages of a ministry. And how to determine God's leading is very difficult a lot of times. Providential circumstances play a big part. God's Word, often God will speak to your heart on something through His Word, or He'll confirm a decision on where you begin your ministry through the Word. And then counsel from leadership. And this one on counsel from leadership is not at all always the easiest, at least it hasn't been for me. I have never wanted to go where the leadership wanted me to go. Now, I may just be a rebel at heart, but eventually I've gotten the picture that this is what God wanted me to do, and at times it's been really difficult. A few years ago, it was on my heart to go to a certain place in the U.S. when we came back from Okinawa. And I had done a lot of praying. I had gotten a lot of scripture passages that had confirmed that this is where I should go. I had consulted with two or three of the men who, a couple of them were in leadership of the navigators. And everybody was for it, and I was excited about it. I had it all mapped up. I had my strategy all worked out for the first couple of years. And when I came back, they said that they just didn't feel it was God's will. Well, this went on and on and on, and they were trying to decide a place where I might go where I wouldn't do too much harm. And I was still holding out for California, a certain place out there. And the RDs, who at that time were to make this decision, just couldn't get it on their hearts to make this decision, or at least to confirm it. And yet God didn't lay anything else on their hearts either. Well, this went on for 4 months, 4.5 months. Well, I was running around trying to make my time count, you know, visiting friends and givers and guys that we'd worked with and so on. But it got pretty touch and go and pretty rough at times, just waiting. And finally, it was at the RATS conference in 1968, which many of you remember, that we were supposed to boil this thing down to a decision. Well, the last place I wanted to go was to the East Coast. You know, I had several other objectives that I would be willing to go to, but the East Coast was the last. And, well, they dealt with this several times during that week, the RDs, and they couldn't come up with a conclusion. Finally, the morning of the last day, I was out in the woods by myself, just praying. And as I was praying, it occurred to me that I was trying to determine God's leading as opposed to these 12 men who really walked with God. And it occurred to me that I was being quite egotistical in assuming that I could know God's will for my life better than all 12 of those put together who knew me quite well. And when that hit me, it occurred to me that I should be much more responsive to the God's direction through the leadership than what I had been. So I confessed my sin to God right there, and I came walking out of the woods. Rod Sargent met me on the road, put his arm around my neck and said, "Well, we've decided where you should go." And I said, "Great, where am I going?" He said, "Well, you're going to the East Coast." So I said, "Well, Rod, I appreciate that." I told him a little about my time with the Lord and that probably the night before I might have quit the navigators, or I might have really struggled with it at least for a long time. Well, I believe that God allowed maybe that whole 4 months of struggle to get me to a place where I was finally ready to commit this thing in my life. Well, I didn't realize that I was assigned to D.C., and I was told that I'd be there for 3 or 4 years at least. And within 8 months, I was asked to take another job somewhere else, and I turned it down. And I really wrestled with it, but I stuck with my convictions on it, and I turned it down. But it wasn't until a little later that I realized that I probably would have accomplished the same thing had I told the leadership I would go. And God could have changed the plan if it wasn't His will for me to go there. And as it ended up, there were some hard feelings on the part of some people. But the end result, we all concluded that I should be where I am and that I shouldn't have made that move. But my response was wrong, and I just wanted to share on that a little bit on how to determine God's leading, either in place of ministry or in response to counsel from leadership. When and how one claims promises. Now, sometimes you get promises prior to going to a place. And I usually have made it a point to do so, really trusting God even after the decision is made, asking God to really burn in my heart some promises from His Word. And I'll touch on that in a moment. But I think that it's important to get these promises before going to the assignment. And you may get them through your regular Bible study. You might get them from messages or time with another person. And then another important factor that I've found, once on the scene, claiming some new promises periodically. Now, in our region out on the East Coast, we've made it a policy for the last 5 years and a couple of years before that on Okinawa that all the key men would claim one promise for the year for his ministry and claim one promise for the year for his life. And so this is the same type of thing that I do for the ministry. When I recently got the responsibility for New England, I asked God to give me a promise for New England. And it was a passage that wouldn't be particularly moving to a lot of people, but to me it really clicked. And it's where Jesus was saying to Peter, and he said unto Simon, fear not, from henceforth thou shalt catch men. And well, that whole New England thing, it's new, it's tough, and God just sealed it to my heart that He's really going to give us men up there. And I took that promise. It just burned in my heart, and though it didn't seem to be a real revealing promise, it as I've reviewed it over and over, it's been very significant. And I am asking God to do great things in New England as a result of that promise and others. Then you want to seek all the prayer support you can get. I was talking to Nate Mirza last night, and he said he has to go out and visit friends now who are giving and thank them for their gifts. But he said the thing he's going to do most is challenge them to keep praying. He says, boy, God can provide a few cows from those hills. But, boy, it's tough getting prayer support. And it's very important, I think, that you get good prayer support behind your ministry. And the way to do that, you got to get information out. You got to get a letter out, prayer requests out on a regular basis, and personal letters. And when I took a check on our mailing list about 3.5 years ago, I got back over 200 cards indicating that they pray every day for us. Well, you get 200 people praying every day for you, and God is going to bless. And so I would encourage you to get all the prayer support that you can right at the outset. Yeah?
Do they get any feedback on whether they use that? You know, a daily thing?
Yeah, no, I get feedback on that, and in fact, if when I miss a month, I've had a lot of people write and say, we didn't get your prayer scope last month, you know, get us back on the list or something. And I'm sure there are some that are glad when they feel they have been lost. They've been dropped from the list. Once in a while we get requests for that too. But yes, there's been quite a response. And in fact, some of my navigator friends have indicated that they pray every day for us on that, which I greatly appreciate. Yeah, they really do use it. By the way, just any time you want to ask a question or butt in, because until tomorrow, I really am not going to do a great deal with visual aids. And I know that in a workshop, you're not supposed to preach for an hour and a half, so I am going to interact some with you on a couple things here. But anytime you got a question, just pop up.
I don't get your prayer show. What is it in nature? Daily request of prayer per day, per situation?
I have a I call it the prayer scope. It's a little thing I developed about 12 years ago. And I've had it every 2 days. One request for every 2 days. And I've kept it that way for the last 12 years. So about 15 requests per month. And then I haven't used pictures, though. That's a good idea, but it's such a headache to try to get pictures. And I'm sure if I just put a little more time on it, I'd get that. I get my pictures in my letters. I always have a picture in my letter, my prayer letter. And I get a letter out every other month. And so lately, I've decided to put my prayer scope out every other month to avoid the extra expenses. The postage is about $80 on my mailing list. And so that cuts that down. Plus, it takes a little less time for me to produce one every 2 months rather than... So then I produce it for the 2 months. It covers 2 months.
Do you produce that?
Yes, I do that. And I know that violates all principles of management. Nevertheless, that's one of my little things that I do. I feel nobody knows the needs of prayer as well as I do for our ministry. So that's any other questions relating to that? Okay. next point is getting a burden for this base. And we won't spend much time on that. These passages I mentioned, Psalm 126, 5 and 6 and Luke 19:41, you're familiar with those. And then I put Moses in there. He's a pretty good illustration on how he really had a burden for the people. He was very concerned for them. And when they would goof and start worshiping idols and everything, and even when they were at their peak of criticizing him, he and Aaron would fall on their faces in humility before God and just beg for God to spare them. And throughout this period of time, God would wipe out thousands of Israelites, you know, and he would, because of the way they accused Moses. And in one point, he finally got God to stop after 24,000 had been killed by this plague. And Moses just begged God to spare the Israelites. He really had a burden for them. Paul said gladly he would give up his salvation for the salvation of the Jews if they would only believe. Jesus, as he came in Luke 19:41, he came and looked over the city. And as he looked over the city, he wept over it. And I was jogging up in Iowa one day. A couple of years ago, I was speaking at a conference. And I was on the Iowa State University campus, and I was jogging around the campus, and I was going through some of these dorms, and I knew that they were just getting the ministry rolling good, and it was really tough going. And so I really got praying for these dorms as I was running around there, seeing kids go in and seeing kids come out. And I got thinking about a guy being on a floor in there and walking up and down the floor of his wing. And the question I asked myself, as though I were that man, what do I think when I'm walking up and down that aisle? When I see that guy in his room, what do I think? Oh, there's old Bill. Or do I really think, boy, I wonder when God's going to give me an opportunity to talk to Bill I wonder if it's today. Even shoot up a prayer. Boy, God, work in this guy's heart and give me an opportunity to... You know, but I'm afraid the tendency is we go up and down that corridor and we never think about these guys and these gals in the gals' dorms, their spiritual condition and their hunger and their need and the fact that we need to get the gospel to them. And I think that a key to a successful ministry is a sincere burden for the people there. And we have a tendency to get a little too mechanized, I think, too often in our ministries. And as I ran through this campus and I just started claiming some of these men and gals for Christ, I just started weeping as I ran through there. And it just happened, and I really got a burden for those kids. And I just asked God to give some key kids in there who could really get a ministry going. And well, that ingredient, I gave another illustration here of a young man by the name of Al Zelke that was on Okinawa, and I'll make the story very brief, but he was in our Bible studies. He really had a gift for evangelism. He'd led many to Christ. And one day he was in the library, he was doing his Bible study, and the Spirit of God spoke to his heart that he should go and talk to this guy over here. And so I'm too busy doing my Bible study. You know, the guy witnessed quite a bit anyway. And so pretty soon he got the burden again. And he looked over there and the guy was there and, go witness to this guy. No, he didn't do it. So that happened several times. So he got up and he left because it was bothering his Bible study. Well, the next morning, he was a corpsman. And the next morning he was assigned to a special unit in a, here we'd call it a mortuary, you know, where they prepare the dead bodies in the military, whatever that is. And he was to assist in that. So he went in, he was the first one in the room, and there was only one dead body in there, so he was going to start getting some of the preparations made. And so he pulls the sheet down off over this guy's face, and when he looks down at it, he sees it's this guy that he had the Spirit of God stirring in his heart to witness to the night before. And he couldn't believe it, and he looked. And this guy was in his own company. And so he grabbed the guy's arm and looked at the band on his arm, and sure enough, it was the same guy. And he fell on his knees, and he just wept before God. And it really tore him up for a long time, because he realized that this guy went to hell because he had not shared the gospel as God had burned it in his heart to do so. Well, you know, we'll miss opportunities. But the point there, and boy, from that point on, Al Zelke, he never missed an opportunity. And it's that thing, though, the burden on the heart. And I wish there were another way of transmitting that. But I think you get the idea. It's a heart for people, getting the gospel to them, and really having a burden for the campus or the base, and asking God, you know, to do great things, and praying over that whole base, and really asking God to give you a burden for it. The last point on this, just some promises. When I went to North Carolina, I claim some promises for North Carolina. Isaiah 43, 4 and 5 was the key one. Since thou hast precious in my sight, thou hast been honorable, and I have loved thee. Therefore will I give men for thee and people for thy life. And I claimed that, and I set my objectives. And then on the top of all my objectives and my plan for the next 2 years, I put that verse, and I claimed that God would give me these men that I was at, that I strategized to get. Then on the way to Okinawa, God gave me another passage. First of all, I decided to search for a passage in the scriptures that would really be meaningful. And I came across Hosea for no particular reason. And I read through Hosea, and I reread it and reread it, and I got 93 promises out of Hosea. for my ministry on Okinawa for the next 4 years. And I boiled those down into about four different categories, one being leading, and another was warnings. And on the warnings, I had 13 warnings. And within the first 6 months that I was on Okinawa, every one of those warnings attacked me. 13 different things, which I identified the warning when the event took place. And they were really a strength in the time when Satan really hit. And I was able to identify the problem and commit it to the Lord. And then when we came out to Washington, D.C., I claimed quite a few promises. One in particular that I've never shared with a person at all, not even my wife. I've got a promise for the East Coast that's just between me and God. And if he accomplishes that through me or through somebody else eventually, I'll be ready to go home to sing praises the rest of my life. But, this kind of relates to objectives. I won't get into that yet. Any questions at this point? Yeah.
When you claim a promise, do you just list on your heart, words in your heart?
No, I claim many promises. If I get a little one, I write that down. If I get a big one, I write that down. And I'll review these daily. And then usually one really comes jumping out at me. But since being in D.C., 2 years ago, I claimed Zechariah 10, 5, 7, and 12. And it says, these men shall... And they shall be as mighty men which tread down their enemy in the mire of the streets in the battle, and they shall fight because the Lord is with them. Their heart shall rejoice as through wine, yea, their children shall see it and be glad. Their heart shall rejoice in the Lord. The Lord said, I will make my people strong with power from me. They will go wherever they wish, and wherever they go, they will be under my personal care. Well, boy, I got all kinds of things from that passage for my key men for that year. And that's the passage I claimed for my men, that they'd be valiant men, that in battle they'd be winners, and they'd be joyful, they'd have the joy of the Spirit in their life, and wherever they go, that God would be with them. And boy, I just claimed that and had a great year. So, but I had others. I usually get several that I pick up for the year, but one usually really comes zinging out there and really land on it. Yes, Don?
When you say, seek a promise for the place where you're going, are you speaking primarily for yourself, or are you also thinking of taking a team of men in there with you, so these men will be with you in the same promise?
Well, I encourage the men to get promises of their own. And then at the first of the year, we share the promises that we get with each other. So sometimes I memorize their promises. But everybody gets their own promise. And tomorrow, I don't think we'll get on this today, tomorrow I'm going to draw an illustration to that effect on why men need to claim their own promises.
If you are thinking of taking someone with you, by yourself to raise up some men who will be with you, say, in a year from now?
Well, anytime you can take some men with you. I think the navigators as a whole have concluded that this is the best plan by far. So we don't even send people overseas in missionary slots anymore without thinking in terms of sending two in. At least this is our plan right now. And there may be exceptions, but usually, we like to see at least two staff go into a country, so the same would certainly apply in the States. Wouldn't have to be two staff, but a guy should have two, three of his good contacts to help him get going. But if you don't, then you just have the privilege of pioneering it yourself. It's just going to take a little longer before you get a good, solid foundation on which to build a format for a much broader ministry. So you can't develop a broad ministry until you have proper foundation stones to hold the building. So if you go in alone, you can only do so much and expect to build a building that's going to stand. So in the process, you have to develop your own cornerstones. And as you build your key men, so you can build the breadth of your ministry. That it?
Yeah. It's recorded as you're picking up those questions. Could you rephrase them?
All right. If I remember, I'll see if I can do that. Well, I'd like to see if anybody else has any comments on this the subject. Yeah, Joe?
Do you have any comments on building a nucleus as in a military situation as a transient factor?
Building a nucleus? Well, I know what you're talking about. I will probably get into this a little on strategy, but the idea of, I think, though often the hardest spot on the base for a ministry is the permanent party personnel, at least as far as fruitfulness. It seems like you get more fruitfulness out of the schools or out of the transit people. But if you want to have a long-range ministry, you got to go after your permanent personnel. And it's so easy to keep avoiding that because you keep wanting to have the abundance of fruit. So, but to get a nucleus to develop a ministry on, you'll never do it if you keep working with transit people. And that's why I think a lot of our overseas, our overseas worker is better than a lot of our stateside works. They're there for a year or two, and you can kind of count on them. Where here in the States, there are a lot of bases, several bases on the East Coast that we've found. Well, like on one, we found that 80% of the men that we led to Christ transferred within 2 weeks after they came to Christ. Well, it's hard to build nucleus one, you know, out of that. So what we're doing is trying to develop the permanent party personnel, which are a whole different segment of society, and then you've got your key men inside to do the follow-up on a lot of these guys that are making decisions. Yeah, Dwight?
Can you figure out why that's true?
Well, some bases are just highly transit.
Now,
others.
My question is, why do transit people respond more readily than permanent personnel?
I think that the permanent personnel tend to get entrenched in local activities or get into a town or into something around there. Or we find a lot of the guys coming in with squadrons or south schools, I mean, they're just there. They don't know what's going on and ready to tie in with something more open.
Well, I haven't figured it out, Dwight. We're working on it, you know, we're banging away at it, but some guys get weary and they quit, and they go into the fruitful area. That's fine, but it's not going to build a long-range ministry on the base. In order to do that, you got to get your permanent personnel, permanent party. So, I don't know if it's just because they, I just don't know. People that have come in right off that are there just for a short time, they're kind of new to the situation. Now, we do try to go after new people coming on base, and if you got good relations with your chaplains, you can get names of people coming on base and or figure out different means of contacting those new people coming on base, and who many of end up being permanent party. And if you can get them in the early stages of their coming on base, they're looking for friends and looking for help. And so that's a real hot spot. But there aren't very many chaplains that will cooperate too well with you on that. Well, we're getting into strategy a little more, yes.
I was going to ask, do you do much of building a nucleus of guys who get out of the service and stay around?
Well, we do various things with guys that get out of the service. It depends on the objective that we have for the man, whether a man looks like he's definitely going to be staff, whether he looks like potential staff 3-4 years down the line, or if the guy doesn't appear to have the gifts to ever be staff, then that would somewhat determine how we draw him in, and when he gets discharged, whether we ask him to stay or not. Some we encourage to go on to Bible school, some we encourage, some that want to stay around, we encourage them not to, but there aren't very many like that. And I'll show you tomorrow why that is. I've got an illustration that I use for determining stages of ministry. And so on the outer perimeter, you're going to have hundreds in Bible study. So that again gets into the strategy of drawing people in to different ministry stages, eventually into training and then into preparation for staff. So I think depending on the development of the man when he gets out would determine what action we would encourage him to take at that time. But we, out on the East Coast, we're really bending away from this idea of using a guy for the next 10, 20 years. And we've got a lot of guys around that are really terrific guys, but they haven't gotten serious about a profession. They haven't got, because they're so wrapped up in the ministry, and now they're 28, 30 years old, and they're tremendous guys. But it's time that they should be mapping out, or should have mapped out, a profession, because they're not going to be navigators. And we're really encouraging a lot of guys as soon as they get out of the military to go right into college. And in fact, that's without exception. That's a principle on my part in our region. Unless a guy is really, we know he doesn't have it, we encourage him to get into college within the next 6 months if possible, where we used to hold a guy out 2 years. And I could never figure out a reason we did that, so we started encouraging him to get into college right away. Yeah.
Harvey, I've got a small college in the community that two of my men are going to be going to as soon as they get out. Would it, from your point of view, would it be better for me to have them involved with me in the services ministry while they're in college, or try to establish a collegiate ministry there?
Well, we've had experience on both sides on that. And again, we're getting into strategy, and I imagine we're going to have a hodgepodge here, but that's okay. We can burn these tapes anyway. I think that I like the idea of the junior college for most guys. Now, if a guy has got the goods, then you might as well get him into a four-year college as soon as you can, whether he's in your area or not. So then you just thank God for the opportunity to recruit this guy to the ministry or to a certain stage of ministry and navigators, and you send him to be a blessing to that college work if you don't have one. We did develop a college, a junior college work. We've done that twice. And the first time we tried to relate them to the military work, and it just didn't work very good. Oh, we got a couple guys out of it, but it's like putting cats and dogs together. They're just a different species. And though a lot of the principles in working with them are identical, it seems that for a ministry target, keeping them separated is best. So we now have separated a little junior college, Prince George Junior College. We've got about 25 or 30 kids in Bible study there. And we've got a guy who's a team leader who's been around the NAVS now for about 5 years and really a good man. And they're really having a very fruitful and effective ministry. And because of the staff man who has them under his thumb, his not wanting to give them up, I let them have them for one more semester, and then next year I'm putting that junior college work under the university ministry. So it'll be a subsidiary to the university, and he'll be a team leader of the director of the work at our university. It's just a much better situation when you can do that. But there's no problem with developing a little ministry there with some of your own men if you want to keep them around. But I think the key is what is best for the man. And unfortunately, we really get ourselves and what's best for us too often involved. And we really don't do what's best for the man. And so that's helped me a lot in the last couple of years, particularly when I've really tried to think very objectively on what is best for the man. So it might be best for the man to be around one more year. And sometimes it'll help if you get somebody else to help you with counsel on that, because they may not be quite as subjective as you, like the man you report to. And let him, you know, just let him help you on a decision on what to do with the guy. If he's a good man, you want the best for him.
Obviously, it's best not to send some college guys over to the military base then.
Well, I would say you can do it. We did it. And the men that were going to the college, they kept growing like weeds, you know, and they had a great time. It was good for them. But their ministry, the men they reached in the on the camp, well, they reached hardly. They didn't reach hardly anybody on campus, two, three guys. And it was hard for those guys to relate to a military work. So the guys that came out of the military work, it wasn't hard for them. But also, if you're thinking in terms of those guys moving into the college work, then you may want to just let them make that their little ministry pool there. And a junior college work can work. We are finding that. It has been very, very fruitful. This is our second year.
You keep it perpetrating, and can you raise up a man in 2 years?
That's what we're... Well, we keep sliding one in. A guy that has been in contact for a while, and for some reason or other, he's not in school yet, and we dump him in. But within 2 years, a guy could raise up his replacement. Well, of course, the guy will leave the junior college by that time, so you probably have to keep planting a man in there. But now, as far as rallies and the whole thing being part like you got one or two bases, and then, you know, get them involved in all your activities, the banquets and everything. But I think it's kind of like a big base. You try to separate it into two or three or four different sections, and you have a team leader for each section. And because, as soon as you can, you know, we'll get into that strategy some. But if you have some guys at a junior college, don't make them have their rallies. You know, get them in on the big things, and they'll fit in fine on those things. But if they can kind of be developing their own little thing over there, that'll be an incentive factor, and they'll do something. Yeah, Tim.
All right, we've got a situation of six fellows going to a small four-year college, and all of them have been in service, so they're going on GI Bill. And we have kind of based on your council up in Green Lakes, or whatever it was, the conference up in Wisconsin, separated the collegiate and the military thing to the point where the college guys are involved in their own rallies.
Mm-hmm.
And some of their own athletic things, and yet we kind of get together on Saturday for soccer.
I think it's great as soon as it's big enough. So the thing, you don't decentralize until you're big enough to decentralize. And tomorrow I'm going to get into an illustration on that, on decentralizing at the right strategic time. And we had a graphic illustration of that with one of our bases down there, a top military objective. And he'd been good staff man. And he had been banging away like mad, but not much was coming out. And I went down and checked it out, found out that he had divided the base into four places with four guys, and each team only had one or two guys on it. And then they'd each do their thing on the weekend. Well, what can you do with two, three guys? You can't play football. You can't do anything. So I said, man, get that bunch together. They all came together. They were about 15 then, you know, and And so I said, man, you build it up to about 30, 20, 20 to 30, and then split it in half, and then split it in half again, but you don't decentralize until you have to, or until it looks like a healthy thing to do. We can probably speak a little more to that as we go on. Chuck, any comments?
Nope. I'm ready to get into the strategy.
This is our college man right here, so any questions you have. Okay, you ready to get into strategy? All right. So planning and strategy. Is that where? Oh, no. Objectives for ministry. Well, as I looked over these notes, I think it would be best if we cover planning and strategy first and then get back to the objectives. I think that might be the easiest way of doing it. If you don't live by a good plan, you live by a poor one. By Frank Betschker. The point is, you live by a plan of one nature or another. Now, a lot of this you're familiar with already, and I just put it down to remind us, because I need to remind myself often, and I've got my wife in the spot now where she's pretty honest with me. And I don't like to ever have to have my wife yell at me. She never has. So I like to have good hearing. And if your wife isn't getting enough time with you, then she ought to be able to have some way of communicating that with you. Because we have a tendency to get pretty busy. And it's pretty easy to put sacrifice our wife and our children far too often. So that's why I put down here in our planning, the very first thing we need to do is set our plans for our family, our wife, and our children. And that's planning time with the wife and with the children. We won't go into a lot of this unless you want to or need to at a little later time. Thinking time. I was in a seminar about a year ago on management by objectives, and the director of that, I showed him basically what I was doing, and I asked him how much thinking time I needed. And he said, well, you should think no less than 2 days a week. And, of course, who can get time to do that? So the point is, you got an awful lot of thinking to do. And if you're not doing much thinking, then it's a good chance that you're not doing very much good ministry. It takes a lot of good thinking.
Are you, in the course of this workshop, willing to share with us, as a point of reference, your time schedule or how you plan your week or month or whatever?
I can share with you what I have done. Mine is shifting right now quite a great deal because of a couple new responsibilities I've taken on. So I haven't quite got my new schedule figured out yet, but I can give you a little bit of an idea. And I think some guys spend too much time thinking. You know, we had a guy in Okinawa that he got so challenged on this thinking time that he took off a Saturday, left real early in the morning. He was living in my home, got out of the service and was living with us. And as he was leaving, I said, well, where are you going? He said, I'm going out just to get time with God. And so he went. And he came back about noon. And I said, well, how'd the day go? He said, well, it was a little bit confusing and perplexing. I said, well, why is that? Well, he said, I went out and my purpose today was just think. I was just going to go out and think. And I got out there, he said, and I got up on this hill, and I couldn't think of anything to think about. And he just got frustrated, and he came back just totally wiped out. Well, you know, you got to have something to think about. So, but you need to put some time in for thinking. Study time, your own personal study time, some time for your wife. You're responsible for her spiritual life, her time, her activities. And you've got to make sure that she has time for Bible study and for prayer and for her time in with girls and so on. Prayer time. That one can slide by real easy if you're not careful, if you don't plan it in. Family activities. I've found with our kiddies, mine are 6, 8, and 10, and I've found that we don't have to spend a lot of hours often, but I need to do something with them often. So every couple, 3 days, I need to get down on the floor and wrestle with them or play some games with them or break out the Monopoly. And, you know, I got my desk loaded like this. So I just kind of pull the sheet over that whole thing, you know, and I go lay on the floor and I say, well, should we play Monopoly or Hang on, Harvey? Or that's a game, really. And or you want to fight, and half the time they want to fight. And so a lot of times, 15 minutes, you know, they're through. But boy, it's so easy to go and go and go and go and not get that time with those kiddies. And you'll never get as much time as you would like, but you better get as much time as you need. But you got to plan it in. Family activities. And boy, we just picked up skiing as a family about 3 years ago. And so all of our kids ski, and we're learning how, and we really love it. So we all go skiing together. And when a team invites me to come and speak at one of their ski trips, I take my family along. They pay for my skiing, and I preach. And so we get up 3-4 times a year. Looking forward to getting up to New England with Pete McKay and his family here in another month. Weekly time with the wife. And the wife usually likes that alone, but about half that time at least we have another couple with us, so I try to do a couple things at once. We go out for dinner and I take one of the couples out with us and just have a great time, great evening. And we always have a talk time. We never do much of anything else. We go out and we talk. We have a beautiful dinner in a restaurant, you know, that's conducive, an old colonial house or something, you know, and especially when we have people with us, that's the way we spend our time with them. So weekly time with the wife, an exercise program, and so on. Then this second point is real key. Plan your best times for major activities with your key men. And boy, can we violate that one. And we'll speak to that one a little more tomorrow. Man-to-man time, prayer sessions, Bible study, future planning, sessions for certain emphasis, thrust, consolidate, thrust, etc. So if you haven't scheduled time with your key men, you'll never get it. Because your key men are the ones that are on the victory side. And they, quote, don't need your time, unquote. It's only the problem children that need it. And if you don't have a plan that helps you to stay within certain guidelines, you'll get all wrapped up with all those problem people, and it'll take 5 times as long for your key men to grow. Well, they'll keep growing, you know, most of them. Some will fall by the way, but well, it's a common error, especially in the military work.
Why, especially in the military work?
Well, I think the military really gets quite an assortment of people, and so the easiest people to get involved in Bible studies are misfits to society. So it's kind of like a service center. We found in some of our service centers that a service center draws all kinds of people, and you get so many misfits that they demand your time. Right, Tommy? And if you don't have some kind of a plan to have somebody kind of play ding-dong out there with them, you'll get all wrapped up in them, and the good men that come into the service center don't get much attention. Well, the same applies to a base. You got all these misfits. I'll jump ahead with an illustration here for point of view, and we'll refer to it again later. But for years and years, we've been having Christmas dinners for all of our contacts. And boy, very valiantly, Maydell has prepared those delicious dinners, and she'll work for a whole week. And we'll have turkey. I mean turkey. Three or four of those things, you know, 25-pounders. We'll have 100 guys out for dinner. And every Easter, every Christmas, every Thanksgiving, every New Year's, every holiday, everybody for the big dinner, you know. Well, so, we've been doing this for years and years and years and years and years. And seemingly very successful because you get 100 guys out, boy, and you're really, you know, and most of them are guys that are in the Bible studies, but you encourage them to bring out anybody they can, you know. And so about 2 years ago, we decided to challenge this idea. What are we accomplishing through these dinners? So one of these wild-eyed fanatics by the name of Paul Stanley, he's not exactly what you'd call a conformist anyway, he asked the question, how do you know that we're accomplishing anything by this? So let's find out. Well, at one of our Bible studies, I asked, how many of you guys came out to a dinner? And that was one of the points of recruiting you to the Bible studies. Well, out of 80-some guys, you know, not one hand went up. So we checked it through a little more, and as we discussed it, we realized, okay, Christmas. You go around the barracks, you're looking around for guys to bring out for dinner, and what guys are sitting around? Well, only half of the guys can go home, so half of the guys are around for Christmas. But if you and I were around for Christmas, you wouldn't be sitting in the barracks, would you? See, any guy that's worth his salt, he's not going to be sitting around the barracks on Christmas waiting for somebody to invite him out for dinner. So you know who's sitting there? The guy that doesn't have enough energy to get off his duff. So the guy that, you know, the guy can't put it together. Or the guy that can't pick up a date. Or, you know. And so here you are, you're out. You're bringing these guys in, these misfits, you know, the big fat guys and the little skinny guys and the guys that can't read or write, and you bring them in, you feed them. Boy, what a wonderful thing. Well, we could join the Salvation Army and do the same thing. So we realized then that, well, why don't we shift gears and we'll have Christmas dinner for our contacts. So that, for the last 2 years, you know, we've been having our Christmas dinners. We have a dinner. I had 90 out this last Christmas, and there were our staff and our team leaders. And 10 of those were our servers. The other 80 were team leaders and staff. And we had a glorious time. But, you know, we didn't have any misfits there. And that kind of thing is really going to pay off. And then each of the staff, they had it with their team and their key men. But rather than having 50 or 100 out, they have 20, 25 out for Christmas dinner. That's the point. So kind of relating to the question you asked, there are a lot of, it's very easy to pick up a lot of misfits.
And
Chuck asked, why?
Good question, man.
Why is it more, why does it happen more in the military than in college? And that you're prone to pick up these misfits. And the point is, the colleges don't have as many of them because they can't get into college, or they don't have the energy or initiative to go to college. So you really scrape off a bunch of them right there. Okay, where were we? Plan your activities. Don't crowd them. Plan 6 months in advance at least, and I'm sure you guys do that. I've got myself planned up at least a year in advance, and when I first was told to do that, I thought they were crazy, and now I would think myself crazy if I didn't do it. It's not real common with people, and if few weeks ago when a pastor asked me if I'd speak at his conference next May something, I said, man, I'm sorry, I'm already taken up. He said, how long in advance do you align yourself up? I said, well, at least a year. He had never heard of the sort. But it's very important. So if you have your activities all planned, which this kind of overlaps into strategy, you can see that. But if you have your plans made up in advance at least 6 months, you won't crowd your activities. You can get them well spaced, and you can plan the objective for each of the activities rather than just they're kind of falling in on you, you know. Well, today it's time to play football. Why? Why? Because we've always done that. Terrible. And, you know, a banquet, somebody asked me once, man, we had this big banquet. We had 450 people there, I think. Big banquet, big to-do, you know. And fun, and had this band come in and play for us, this rock and roll Christian group, and had a great time. Well, after the banquet, one of the guys asked me, hey, Harv, what was the objective for the banquet? Huh? Man, we had a great time, you know. What do you mean objective? So I could have told him, well, just to have a great time, all of us together from all of the different ministries. That's a valid objective. But see, that I didn't have an objective. We did every couple, few months, you know, we put a big banquet on. This gets into the philosophy of ministry. Number four, use holidays to your advantage, special activities, or personal time with certain men. Chuck, how about you giving us a little idea of what you do on holidays with some of your gang? Would you do that?
Collegiate setting, taking trips.
Yeah.
Like on Easter, well, that's not Easter. Well, yeah, Easter, because it's usually a week break. Or any quarter breaks, semester breaks. And the collegiates go for that. Sometimes it's up to the snow or some other place, and it's a recruiting factor.
Give us a little on what you did last Christmas. Wasn't it this Christmas, or was it a year ago, you had three or four different things they could go to? And
we had a Christmas training program, which is the same idea that we have in summer training programs, and we got to thinking that it's a 2 or 3 week break, and we're just letting that go by every year. And so we took it from Christmas to New Year's. They get to stay home for Christmas, which the folks want, and then they are gone for New Year's, which the folks want. And so we take them off their hands. Let's see if folks are drunk. And it gives us about 6 full days with them. And we had 7 different programs. And
give us the names of those that you can remember.
Well, we had 2 classifications. One, beginning with Christ programs and going on with Christ, which is not quite level 1 and 2, but like it. And the beginning was the basics. And they were those who came to Christ in the fall, which is a tremendous advantage in a collegiate ministry because they've just come to Christ, and you usually have them in January where you normally have them almost till summer. And it's just about summer when you've got them that turned on to getting the help that they need, whereas you now have them that way in January. Those who go to the programs, there's a tremendous advantage too. And then the going on, we had, oh, just various things. Just New Testament. Another one was New Testament survey. I'm sorry, just the Word. That is, the whole idea there was that all of life's answers are in the Word. And so they approached the Word from that point of view. Another one was the New Testament survey. Another was on missions. Another was on personal life and character. And another was on ministry. How to do ministry.
And then your staff taught these?
And the staff was scattered out.
Yeah. You did this on a regional basis? Or
yes,
on
2 years in a row. And we won't do it next year. Urbana.
Oh, you'll be going down to Urbana for the IVF thing, possibly. I see.
But and on quarter break trips, we take trips sometimes even just to other campuses where one campus will go to the other. Those coming in are very excited because they're on a trip and there's a cross stimulation that takes place. We take advantage of it.
Well, this year, on the basis of hearing that a year ago, we've taken advantage of holidays But we haven't taken advantage of them as well as what you had. And so this year we came up with a little strategy ourselves and did something similar to what you did. And the team leader or the staff man would bring in all of his, in one case, his key men and team leaders, and they stayed right in his house, and they spent about 5 or 6 days, I think, like that, and he just dumped it on them for 5 or 6 days, you know, and it's just fabulous. So I appreciated that little nugget. Any questions on that you'd like to ask Chuck at all or anybody else?
Well, just comment on Harvey. You know, the government holiday thing is established already throughout the year. Like, the guys have a holiday falling on a weekend, they get following Monday off, so there's the military ministry that you could use something like that very effectively.
Gives you an extra day?
Yeah, several three-day weekends throughout the year.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I'd say that would come back again on your planning, so that you leave enough weekends open so that when that one comes, you're set up for it.
Right.
You're not crowding too much.
And see, planning in advance, that is not too popular, even in navigator circles. We talk a lot about it, and we think we're good planners, but I have been to a number of conferences where things have not been too well planned ahead of time. And so it's not done as well. So if you set up a seminar, for instance, a three-day seminar for guys from your base, to really have it done well, you need to do a good amount of preparation. If you're going to spend 8, 10, 12 hours a day for 2-3 days with those guys, you got a lot. You got to have a lot to share. So you got to plan it quite a ways in advance.
About what frequency would you say you should have some sort of big deal?
Well, it depends on how big your ministry area is. I think our works, our military works, have something going every weekend, but it's generally a general sports afternoon and rally type thing. And then a larger rally, we break it down so 3 or 4 teams get together. Once a month or once every 2 months for a big rally or a banquet or a pizza fest or something. So one of our objectives, I learned from Leroy years ago, Leroy Imes. He asked me what I thought his primary objective for his area ministry was, and I guessed all kinds of things, you know, evangelism, man-to-man, Bible study, and he said, no, they were all wrong. So then he said, our primary objective is to have a good time. And we always have a good time. And then he said, we get whatever else we can get done, but we always have a good time. Well, I think there's a real key to that, but you can get too busy having a good time. You can be doing it so that it gets stale and monotonous and ineffective. So you got to watch that. And you can also violate the point that was made this morning by Lauren, that you're a creature. And you need to remember that. I violate that one too often. Yeah.
I went with Richard Greger to the Glen Greyhound over Thanksgiving. And he planned it right then and there. We're going back over New Year's. It's next year, a year in advance.
Is that right? Oh, good. For all the military from
Santa Ana, my area.
Uh-huh.
I just joined him in San Diego. Uh-huh. They went skiing. That's to be the whole purpose of going.
To have a good time.
Hollis didn't ski, but that was 45 with skiing.
Is that right? You had a great time, huh? How many of you?
80 or something like that.
Yeah? And you stayed how long?
100 next this year.
How long did you stay?
Just 4 days over Thanksgiving.
Uh-huh.
We left on Wednesday night and got back Sunday night.
Then did you do anything? And did you, one of you preach at night or something?
We had... Leroy spoke just once.
Yeah.
Back in the south, I forgot.
Now, we've tried a ski trip. For 1 year, we tried ski trips with nobody preaching, nothing, just fellowship. And every time we left one of those things, it just seemed like something was missing. And I thought, well, it's because we're in such a rut, you know, we can't have a good time without preaching. But after that year, we decided to do a little preaching at every one of those little events. It seems to be you know, a pretty strategic part of our primary objective. Yeah.
We're going to stay about 6 days is next time, 27th December through about the 2nd of January. That's our tentative plan.
Good.
We'll be part of the preaching area.
I wish Glen Area was a little closer to us.
I've just to ask a question here. I've wondered, the military men aren't used to sitting in classrooms like the students are. So would they be uncomfortable, say, take a week on a training program pretty intensive? Would that be a little heavy shift for them?
No.
They can pick that up real quick.
I don't think so. Yeah.
Yeah, like our week-long...
Change is good.
Our week-long training programs eased... We have 24 hours in Bible study. They study 24 hours that week in Bible. And then there's an hour's lecture on each study. And then there's one other lecture each day. And then they discuss their Bible study at another time. So it's a pretty jam-packed, heavy program, but it's very effective, and the guys really get charged up on it. Well, let's go on. So use the holidays to your advantage, but you got to plan them way in advance. Special planning sessions for activities, assigning personnel to responsibilities, and holding dry runs. Such as conferences and seminars and, you know, like you put on a rally, and the tendency, if your group isn't very large, the tendency is to be so slipshod on it that night as Joe comes in the door, you say, "Hey, Joe, would you lead singing tonight?" You know, well, that is not the way to put on a rally. The guy should know at least a day in advance, you know, so he can give it a little thought, a little prayer. And even though it seems to be a little matter, if your rally is going to come off good, have a good tone to it, you really have to have it planned. Now, planning and strategy, getting into the strategy a little bit more, an illustration by McElroy, who was Secretary of Defense. Prior to that, he was, as a young lad, he was about 18 years old when he went to work for Procter & Gamble's. And he decided at that point that in 20 years he was going to be president of Procter & Gamble's. So at 18 years old, he decided, you know, this is where I am. He was emptying garbage cans and, you know, or trash baskets. He was kind of an office boy. And so you go right on up your years. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Well, so on anyway. So here's 20. And so I read this big article on this, quite a lengthy article, on how he acquired this. And he said, well, he set his objectives for each year. First of all, he set them in the 5-year stages. And so he realized that if he was going to be here in 20 years, he had to be here in 15, he had to be here in 10, he had to be here in 5. Now, in order to get to this position in 5, he had to be here in 2, he had to be here in 3, here in 4, and then he'd be able to be there in 5. So the premise that he worked on was that he would not squeeze, push, or kick, or polish apples to get that promotion. He would just be the most qualified man for the job. And he'd just watch for those openings. And so the first 5 years were pretty easy. He hit them almost on the dot to the year. But as he got up here, it was a little harder, and sometimes he'd have to really give himself to learning things and even taking seminars and stuff to be the most qualified man for that stage of, or that job. And to the year, 20 years later, he was president of Procter & Gamble's. Well, that won't work for every guy. But the point is, he had a plan. He had a system. He had a strategy. And many of the people that were interviewed on this article said that he never squeezed anybody, pushed anybody. He had never had an enemy in the company. never polished any apples. He was just always the most qualified man. So I think the point being is a plan. You know where you're going, and you know how it all fits together. When I was aboard the ship in the Navy, I was aboard a seaplane tender, and I had come to know the Lord, well, probably when I was a very young guy, but when I was 24 years old, I recommitted my life to the Lord. And I got a little bit of help, and I met the navigators a couple months before I went aboard this ship. So I was just getting started in Bible studies and memory, and got on this ship, and first couple months, I was just playing it kind of cool. I didn't do much witnessing. I didn't want to get a false image, you know, and then I realized I wasn't accomplishing much. So after about 2 months, I started witnessing, and some guys started coming to know the Lord. Then I started figuring out how much time I had left in the Navy, how much time left on the ship, and how many men on the ship. So there were 875 men, and I had 22 months left aboard ship. So I divided this into here, and I forget exactly how that comes out, but it's about 40, huh? 40 witnesses a month, is that correct? Then I thought, well, how am I going to do this? Well, by this time I had 6 guys in Bible study. And two or three of them were already Christians, and I had rounded them up and we got going in Bible study. So I thought, well, 6 of us into 40 would make about, what, 7. So that means that we would have to witness 7 times a week. Or a month. Well, I decided to cut that down. I decided to work it on the multiplication basis. So I took, if 6 of us right now were witnessing to 3 a week, that'd be 18 witnesses this week. Then I tried to project how many men would come to know the Lord within how many weeks, and then I would add those and I'd bring them into the multiplying factor. So pretty soon there are 10 of us at 3 witnesses a week. And anyway, I figured it out that by the time my 22 months were up, we could have witnessed to all 875 men. Now the point being, I don't know how many we witnessed to, but I'm sure we got over half of them. And we had about 48 guys in Bible study when I left, and God really blessed. And we didn't know much of what we were doing, but we had a plan, we had an objective, and we had our sights set on it, and we were determined to go after it. We'd take a cruise, see, and I'd say, I'd get the key guys together, you know, we'd be up in this officer's wardroom. We got the lecture room for our Bible studies every night when we were underway. So I said, well, guys, boy, we're on this cruise now, we're going to be gone for 2 months. How many souls should we claim for this cruise? So we decided on this one to Bermuda that we'd claim 5. 5 guys would accept Christ. And so on the way over to Bermuda, before we got there, there were 4 decisions already. And then while we were there, there was only 1 or 2. And there, you know, and it occurred to me much later that what happened was we had our objective set and we almost accomplished it. So we kind of relaxed. There was no problem in reaching another 4, another 8, another 10. But we'd kind of set it, and we'd kind of reached it, and so we kind of fell into neutral. But we did get our objective. So each cruise we took an objective, and every time we reached it, you know, how many men would come to Christ. Now, I think this can be easily applied to a military base or a campus, either one. And as I've illustrated here, I've given you a little plan on what I set up for North Carolina when I went down there. And that was back in the dark ages. I was the only one down there in the southeast. Didn't know what to do. Banged away at this Marine base. But before going, this is the plan I came up with. Before even going to North Carolina, I laid out this plan. 2 month plan, 6 month plan, 8 month plan, and a 2 year plan. And these, I just took these out of a form that I've kept since then. And this is the way I planned it. Witness twice every day for this 2-month period. Win 3 men to Christ during that time. Begin 15 men in Bible study. Meet and get to know chaplains. Attend the chapel and weekend sports, etc. Those were my primary objectives for the first 2 months. Then the first 6 months, the 6 months plan, from 2 months to 6 months, the next 4 months, witness 3 times a week. You can see I've cut it down a little. Once with the contacts, win 8, begin 35 in Bible study, meet with 3 men, man to man, weekend sports, rallies, Andrew dinners, get involved at the chapel. The 12-month plan, my witnessing is cut down again a little. Witness 2 times a week, once with contacts. Win, and I didn't come up with any number there because it was hard for me to determine how many would be in Bible study. Begin 75 in Bible study, 35 carrying on. Meet with 5 men, man to man, set up conference. This was my first conference, and that was held at Camp Haines, a Boy Scout camp. And, boy, we about got froze to death. I'll never forget that thing. That about wiped us out. But I set that up, see, a whole year in advance, and we hadn't even had 1 man yet. And I decided we'd have a conference somewhere before that 12-month period. And then our activities, I thought through on a few activities. And then I decided that we should have 3 men who would be reproducers by that time. Then my 2-year plan, you can see that. And my ultimate goals, 1, so many Timothys in my lifetime, and so many Timothys in 3 years at North Carolina. I was only there 2.5. Well, as I was going along, let me give you a little picture of what happened in North Carolina. And then I'll open this for questions for whatever time we have left. But this could be very helpful to some of you to not make the same mistake I made. Well, I got in there, and here's Jacksonville, North Carolina. That's my target. 30,000, 40,000 Marines, whatever that is. Then Cherry Point, that's another little base over here. And I met a guy there by the name of Paul Drake. And we had a hard time getting anything going over here, so I shifted gears. I still lived here, but, well, that's right. I moved up to New Bern, which is up near here. Moved up there for 2 months. Moved into a little apartment. It had 1 bed, and my bathroom and my kitchen were the same room, and that was really a weird thing. But I spent about 2 months there. And made contact with Paul Drake, and then with Irwin Coffinberry and a few others there. Then God started opening up things over here, so we got going there. Then I met some businessmen up here in Greensboro, North Carolina. And this was Bill Webster and Jim Webster and some of those boys. So, man, these guys were hot to go, and they tried to get me to come up there once a week and meet with them in Bible study. And I told them, man, I couldn't do that. My thing was down here, and I just didn't have time for going 200 miles, you know, up there. So I just kept telling them I couldn't do it. Then I met a college kid that was at Dunn over here, and he got excited. And he knew another guy that was at North Carolina State College. And the two of them tried to get me committed. So finally, I was committed to making a trip up here every week, swinging by here, getting time with these guys in this college, these guys in this college here. I'd do this on the weekend. I'd come back about 4 a.m. on Sunday or Monday morning. Then we got something going over here at the big Army base, Fort Bragg. And we really had things going there. We got the airborne unit, and we had about 25 guys going there. We had a special forces unit, had a bunch there, and then some others over in another section. So I'd swing in here, then hit this, and then hit this, and then back here, and I'd get over there once a week. Then, I forget. There were 1 or 2 other targets over there that were pretty fruitful. So I was banging away about 1.5 years, and man, we had people all over the place in Bible study. And I thought, boy, what a great success. God was really blessing. And then one day I asked Harv, you know, I looked at my objectives. And I said, well, Timothy's, huh? One of my primary jobs or objectives is Timothy's. How many Timothy's in 3 years in North Carolina? It's three. So I said, well, who's my Timothy? So I says, well, Paul Drake is one of my Timothy's. Is he really? Well, not yet. Well, what would you have to do to make Paul a Timothy? I don't know, I'd have to get more time with him. How much more? Oh, man, I'd have to get a couple days with him every week. Well, can you do that? No, can't do that. Okay. Ken Choate was here. He went on trips with me once in a while. What do you have to do to make Ken Choate a Timothy? Well, got to get more time with him. Can you do that? No, too busy. Jim Webster. How about him? He's a Timothy. Yeah, but I'd have to get more time with him. What I finally decided to do, number one, this was my objective. This happened. So I said, okay, we'll cut that. We'll cut this. We'll cut that. And we'll get myself some more time so that I can accomplish my objective in raising up Timothy's in this area of ministry that God had sent me to. Well, as a result, I didn't have to cut this altogether, but I cut it down to about once every 2 weeks, and I'd go up and I'd make the swing in one day. So I'd hit this one early in the afternoon with the guys there. I cut that one out, and I would hit that one, and then we started coming up with a few Timothy's. So you can cut your own throat by seemingly being successful, but completely missing your objective. And the only way you can keep from missing your objective is to know what it is. So if you don't have your objectives well-defined, and if you don't have a plan, then you'll never hit it. Dawson Trotman often said, if you aim at nothing, you're sure to hit it. And that's what happens too often. So in my plan was to have three Timothys, and by the time we left there, God had given us more than that. And so you can see, I'm listed under, in the book here, midway correction. And I found myself that I was running too thin. There were no Timothys. And so I made a midway correction. And this is very, very important to make a midway correction thing. We'll deal with that tomorrow. Any questions on this thing that we just covered? The same can apply to a base. You got one base and you got several sections. And you make plans. You plan what God is going to enable you to do over there. And if you've got team leaders, we'll deal with that tomorrow as to how you can challenge and teach and train them to really be totally responsible before God for their ministry response, for their ministry in their section. And if you don't establish certain principles with them, they'll just kind of do nice things and they'll kind of fizzle along. And somewhere they've got to do this kind of a thing, something that they can really believe God to use them to do. And by the way, on that one on North Carolina, every objective that I set was met and more in the timing. Well, you know, I'm no brain, but man, I had something to shoot for. Boy, I got to have 8 come to know the Lord by 6 months. That doesn't sound like many. But boy, it kept me humping till, you know, we got 8. And I knew then that I needed so many more. You know, and I better get a head start on that, so keep going. So I had a challenge from myself as unto God on the objectives I wanted to reach. Okay? When we went to Okinawa, I won't take the time to illustrate that, but I set up a similar kind of a plan. I established it on, I knew that we had three faithful men there when I got there. And so I was number four, and the three of us worked it out. One out of ten that I witnessed to will make some kind of a decision and get involved, and one out of three of those will go on. So one out of 30 witnesses I can usually plan on sticking. Now that's been my experience. Yours may be very different. You may have a much higher, much better batting average than I do.
Could you get a batting average again?
Just one out of 10 usually would make some kind of a decision, and one out of 3 decisions would continue on. For one period of time in Okinawa, we had about 68% of converts that were carrying on. So that was the highest I've ever had. We're not running that high now. Wish we were. Another thing that I had on my objectives for and part of my strategy for Okinawa was to have a ministry on every base by the time the 4 years were up. And at the 2.5 year point, I was drawing up a map to present at one of our conferences in Japan to show what was going on in Okinawa. And it occurred to me at that point that we had a ministry going on every base on Okinawa. About 15 of them or so. 18, something like that. So that was another objective that I had set, though. It was something I could look at, and I was surprised when I realized we had something on every one of them. I wasn't aware of that until I made up the map. And again, on Okinawa, we exceeded every goal that I set. So I became pretty convinced that if you set objectives, you get a plan, and you stick with it, you got a good chance of reaching it. In D.C., the same is applied, basically. And right now I'm working on a third stage of ministry. I've been there for several years. And so we've accomplished, my first objective was accomplished about a year early. And so the second objective was accomplished again about a year early. And so right now I'm setting up a whole new structure for setting my objectives for my region. And it kind of scares me because I want to set it for 3, 5, and 10 years. And I've got a fair idea what we can expect God to do in the next 3 years. And that scares me enough. But 5 and 10 years, it's completely out of sight. And so I'm having a couple of our leadership come out and give me a hand on this, because I don't want to underestimate what we should really believe God to do. And when you think of a place like New York City or something, you know, 14 million people, I just have a hard time setting an objective for that. But we're going to be in there one of these days. If I have to go myself, I hope God doesn't plan it that way, but we will be there in that jungle, as it's referred to. Place of the Nav home, that's a whole other subject, and you all probably don't have any questions on that anyway. And if you should want any information on it, at a DM conference, I just gave a workshop on that, and it was a one-session deal. And Metzger just told me this afternoon that he has it taped and it's available through headquarters if you want it on the place and the purpose of the Nav home. I don't think this is the time to go into that. Mid-year evaluation, very, very important. And making corrections and adjustments necessary. And then I just threw in a little deal here for you in the back on a conference chart. And you may want to look at it, you may not. It's something I developed about 12 years ago. I've revised it a couple times, but it just helps you in having a format for planning a conference or a rally or a seminar. It helps so you don't have to think through it every time on what assignments are necessary. So you just fill names in those little blocks. It's worked real good for me. I'm not pressing this junk off on you. I just thought it might be helpful. Any other questions on planning and strategy? I think we'll cover some of this a little more thoroughly tomorrow as we get on objectives. And then we'll cover this little target thing. And tomorrow I'll have you do a little work developing a couple things yourselves. So, you can look through that material and we'll cover the rest of that tomorrow. I think this would be a good place to close off.